Headlines: Iran and Venezuela launch their first direct shipping line as part of measures to boost the mutual cooperation. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency is in Tehran for talks over the country's nuclear program. And Russia says it will no longer rely on the West as an energy partner as tensions remain high on the Nord Stream pipeline's blasts. Welcome. Our top story: Iran and Venezuela have launched their first direct shipping line as the two countries work to step up cooperation in different fields. The Iranian embassy in Venezuela says a ship was already dispatched to the Latin American country last month. The embassy says one ship will be sent to Venezuela every 3 months. The shipping line has been launched to support merchants and traders from both countries. Iran and Venezuela have pledged to boost bilateral ties in various fields. They have signed a 20-year strategic agreement to expand cooperation on energy and agriculture, among other issues. The document was signed last June during a visit by Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro to Iran. Both countries are under U.S. sanctions and are looking for alternatives to neutralize the pressure. And the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency is in Tehran for talks with Iranian officials. Rafael Grossi is scheduled to meet high-ranking officials, including the head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami. Technical nuclear issues are high on the agenda. Grossi's visit comes ahead of a meeting of the IAEA Board of Governors on Monday. Iran and the agency are at odds over several issues concerning Iran's nuclear activities. Those issues include claims that Iran has enriched uranium to nearly 84% purity. Now, Tehran has dismissed the claim. Earlier this week, Islami said there has been no deviation in Iran's nuclear activities and that ambiguities in IAEA reports have been resolved. Time now for our news review segment, where we take a look at one of our stories in a little bit more detail. Israeli forces have killed a Palestinian teen during a raid in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry has confirmed the death, saying the victim was 15-year-old. He was fatally shot in the back near the entrance to the town of Azun, east of Qalqilia. Two more teenagers were also wounded, one critically. The latest death increases the number of Palestinians killed by Israelis this year to 68. According to Palestinian media, 30 lost their lives in February alone. The death toll includes 4 killed by Israeli settlers. Joining us for more on that is Dawood Kutab, a Palestinian journalist from Amman. And we also have Wafa Al-Udaini, a Palestinian activist and journalist from Gaza City in the besieged Gaza Strip. So, Mr. Kutab, if I could start with you. We've got a situation here where a 15-year-old has been fatally shot in the back. In other words, he was either walking away from the Zionist entity's forces or running away from its forces. So he was not, in essence, posing any direct threat to the Israeli regime forces. But they still killed him. Why did they kill him?
Well, the Israeli government and the Israeli Ministry of Defense has raised the agreement on what is allowed by soldiers, and they've basically given them a green light to shoot to kill anytime they feel like they want, even if their life is not in danger. And this is a big question mark of a war crime that is taking place continuously, where Israeli soldiers are not protecting themselves or anything like that, because they keep saying we have the right to defend ourselves, but they're actually assaulting Palestinians and killing them, injuring them, and continuing the terrorization of the population because they are rejecting and resisting the occupation. This is a big problem, and it falls within the policy of the Netanyahu, Ben-Gvir, Smotrich governments, which has claims that the West Bank is part of the Jewish people's rights and that they will annex it anytime they want. And so they feel like they are running their own country, even though it occupied territories by international law.
Okay, let me turn to Wafa al-Udaini. You know, so we're seeing a record Palestinian death tolls this year. Two massacres already, one in Nablus, one in Jenin before that. Settlers going on the rampage. And then we have, now we've got the Zionist regime wants to execute Palestinian prisoners who had conducted retaliatory operations. What's your take on that?
Actually, this is not bizarre for the occupation authorities. Indeed, the Palestinian detainees inside the occupation jail, they endure all kind of ill-treatment and torture and subjugation. And for your information, like over than 250 Palestinian inmates lost their lives inside the Israeli occupation custody while they are in their custody. And indeed, they witnessed the slow death inside the occupation jail. But now with this draft bill, you know, they mean to heat the Palestinian arena, because the Palestinian people will never allow this thing to happen to Palestinian detainees, to their sons inside the Palestinian occupation jails. And actually, you know, that this death penalty, it is against the Israeli authorities' law. So they just want to practice it against the Palestinian detainees, not against the Israeli settlers when they commit any crime in their you know state, as they claim.
Okay, if I just want to go back to Mr. Kotab. You know, Mr. Kotab, we talk about the massacres that we witnessed this year in Jenin and Nablus, and you know, the newly formed Palestinian resistance factions in both cities, both occupied cities, they were very heroic during those massacres. They lasted, the Zionist entity, the occupation, dispatched special forces, and the massacre, they resisted, these youth in both cities resisted for 3 hours until they forced, albeit the Israelis committed massacres, but they forced the Israelis out of the two cities. Do you want to share your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, in military and political terms, both the Jenin and the Nablus raids were a big failure. Yes, they killed a number of Palestinians, but the whole idea that they entered into areas that are under the Palestinian control, under the guise of that they're seeking people who shot at them. But in the meantime, because of the long resistance, as you said, the heroic resistance, they were shooting everybody around them. And as a result, the West Bank erupted in revenge attacks, including in Jerusalem and then in Jericho and so on. So the cycle of violence, instead of being down, it has been revived, and the Palestinians are in a more courageous move now that they are not taking the Israeli orders and Israeli terror into account, and they are heroically standing up for their people. Now, of course, that has weakened the authority of President Abbas and his ability to represent Palestinians. And now these armed groups are becoming very popular in the Palestinian areas, and they pose a threat to the political powers, which are not doing anything in their eyes to protect the Palestinian population and to bring an end to the occupation. So this is where we're at today.
Right. Wafa Al-Odeini, speaking of President Abbas, we saw the Palestinian Authority hold the talks with the Zionist entity in Jordan to de-escalate tensions in the occupied West Bank. Do you see anything, any points in these talks, which, you know, these talks have been going on for 70 years, perhaps you can say. Do you see any points in these kind of talks, or is the only way to liberate Palestine and to liberate Al-Quds is for the armed resistance to carry on with their retaliatory operations?
Okay, actually the negotiation and the talks with the occupation authorities, actually it is meaningless, you know. And you know that since long years, the PA negotiate and talk with the occupation authorities, but they gain nothing. If you look on the ground, you feel that there is nothing on the ground of care. All the negotiation just resulted on something or some benefit only for the occupation, but nothing occurred for Palestinians. Their situation and their condition is exacerbating every single day. As you report like many times, like every single day there is a Palestinian killed. There is a home demolition. There is seizing of land more and more. They just declare Jerusalem, all Jerusalem, as the capital of Israel. They consider Israel, they want it as a Jewish state, and they declare this many times, but it seems that the PA doesn't learn from its lesson, and they have no options but to stay as they are. And we as Palestinians, you know, as you see in the occupied West Bank, because the people there feel disappointed from this negotiation and from the coordination with the occupation. So they since 2014, they started to resist the occupation, to use the armed resistance. And you know the Lion Dens, the newly group that emerged in the occupied West Bank, they emerged because they feel disappointed from their situation. Their people are being, you know, violated. Their homes are being raided every single day. The people, so many children and women got murdered and massacred in front of the cameras, and nobody held Israel accountable for what they are doing, what their crimes against Palestinians. So that's why they resist the occupation. They use the armed resistance. And you know that the Palestinians, during the past years, they use the popular resistance, but also the popular resistance is so important.
Okay, thank you very much indeed for that. Let me thank our guest, Dawood Kutab, is a Palestinian journalist joining us from Amman. Wafa Al-Odeini is a Palestinian activist and journalist joining us from Gaza City in the besieged Gaza Strip. That brings an end to another edition of the News Review. Moving on, Russia says it will no longer consider the West an energy partner as tensions remain high over blasts that hit the Nord Stream gas pipelines last year. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says the energy policy of Russia will be oriented towards reliable and credible partners like India and China. He also said Moscow will not allow the West to blow up gas pipelines again. The blasts last year took place in September, hitting the Nord Stream pipelines carrying Russian gas to Germany. Moscow blames some Western states, including the US, and has called for an international investigation. They deny any involvement. Late last month, Russia called for a UN Security Council meeting over the issue. The call came after an investigative American journalists revealed that the U.S. Navy had bombed the pipelines. Ukrainian forces are struggling to hang on to their positions in Bakhmut, an eastern town that has been the site of the longest and bloodiest battle since the Russia-Ukraine war broke out. The battle for Bakhmut is raging around the clock. That's according to a senior Ukrainian military official. Now, he says the situation is critical and that Kiev needs to get its hands on more ammunition as soon as possible. Ukrainian forces are said to have repelled dozens of Russian attacks in the past 24 hours. The Russians are trying to encircle Bakhmut from the north, east and south. Capturing the town would enable them to seize the rest of the strategic Donbass region. In the meantime, the Ukrainian military has reported Russian missile attacks in central Zaporizhia region and the southern Kherson region. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
About you. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Be friends with the merciful God from your early childhood. This is a part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in Taklif celebration for a number of schoolgirls on the eve of the birth anniversary of Imam Ali alayhi salam, February 3rd, 2023. The advice I wish to give you young people, my advice to my dear daughters, is that you become friends with God. Try to become friends with the merciful God from the start of your youthhood. What is it like to be friends with God? One of the ways of becoming friends with God is when you are talking with God in prayers to pay attention to this, that you are talking with God. You are speaking with God. Learn the meaning of the words in prayers. Learn from your elders and teachers the translation of Surah Al-Hamd, Surah Al-Ikhlas, and what you are saying when you are bowing and prostrating. When you pray, pray in such a way that you are talking with God. This is becoming friends with God. This is one of the ways of becoming friends.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another way of becoming friends with God is to be careful to avoid the deeds that he has told you not to do, and to do the deeds that he has said you should do. This is the way to become friends with God. Today you have bright hearts. You have shining hearts. You have pure hearts. Become friends with God from today. Now, you said this beautifully in your anthem. You said that this is Iran, your country. Dear Iran, had great women in the past, and I can tell you that today the number of outstanding women is much more than in the past. We have important outstanding women in all the scientific sectors, in applied work, in jihadi activities and positions of responsibility, in management, etc. These things are a source of pride. Outstanding women in a country is a source of pride for any country that has outstanding women. And there are many such women in our country. You too must try to become one of these women. How? Study your lessons. You should study your lessons well. You should do your homework well. Work, think, and read books so that, God willing, you will be one of these great women in the future.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Hit me. Please.
We the people.
More than 10% of Americans over the age of 12 use antidepressants. Antidepressants are among the most frequently used medications in the United States. Newly released study shows how antidepressants help bacteria resist antibiotics. Global survey shows that in 2019, antimicrobial resistance killed more people than HIV/AIDS or malaria. The fentanyl drug crisis is on the rise in the United States. Fentanyl is a cause of overdose. While the country's drug epidemic killed close to 110,000 people in 2021, it seems the drugs that are meant to cure people are making the population sicker. Sick on drugs. The United States Center for Disease Control and Prevention announced that, at the end of May 2022, close to 40% of American adults had experienced symptoms of depression and anxiety during the past month, a quarter of which received antidepressants or other psychiatric drugs. The New York Times also reported that, between 2017 and 2021, American teenagers' use of antidepressants rose by 41%. Most adults that feel depressed do not take antidepressants, but the total number of the ones that do are still staggering. More than 10% of Americans aged 12 and above take antidepressants in the United States. This is while in 1990, less than 3% of adults had taken these drugs.
I think in this country, certainly stigma has really changed in the last 20 years, and certainly with our younger population, they're talking about anxiety and depression a lot, whereas people, you know, in my generation and older didn't talk about it so much.
Being unable to connect with large groups of people in the way that, you know, humans are used to. It was really hard just to wake up, you know? Being asleep was my favorite thing about the day because I didn't have to be awake and be thinking and wanting to be with people but not being able to.
The rise of the use of antidepressants is while Nature magazine recently published a study stating that antidepressants are causing drug resistance and resistance towards antibiotics in particular. Chinhua Guo, the author of this study, working at the Australian Centre for Water and Environmental Biotechnology at the University of Queensland in Brisbane, became interested in the possible contribution of non-antibiotic drugs to antibiotic resistance in 2014. Why is it that so many Americans take antidepressants?
I think the first thing to look at is that these figures parallel the decline in the rise, if you like, of inequality in wealth inequality in America, and also the decline in living standards of many, many Americans, specifically lower income Americans who have really not seen their wages and their work compensation increase substantially for over 30 years. And it's only just in this very last period from COVID that there's been any increase at all, but that's still less than inflation. That's the major cause.
Chinhua Guo reported that even though antidepressants are a completely different class of drugs, they are driving bacteria to develop resistance against antibiotics. He adds that even after a few days of exposure, bacteria develop drug resistance not only against one, but multiple antibiotics. This would mean that antidepressants may help the rise of superbugs in the environment or the human body.
Without changing people's habits and developing new drugs quickly, drug resistance is going to pose a huge threat to human health. And it's going to do so in our lifetime.
The findings of this new study is extremely important and alarming. Antibiotic resistance is a significant public health threat throughout the world. It is estimated that 1.2 million people have died as a direct result of antibiotic resistance in 2019, and the number is only expected to climb. In fact, global survey shows that antimicrobial resistance took the lives of more people in that year than HIV/AIDS or malaria did. What does the findings of this recent study mean for the United States?
When it comes to precise interaction of drugs, antidepressants or antibiotics and other kinds of treatment drugs, for infections and so forth, the issue, these precise mechanisms that can take place really have to be studied by expert biochemical, medical, chemical researchers. And there are interactions. But secondly, you have a lot of co-conditions among Americans concerning their health. If they are taking antidepressants or antibiotics, you have a very high rate of obesity. People are fat. They are depressed. That strains the organs in the body. It creates a disposition for more illness of all kinds, respiratory problems in the gastro and other systems. So there is not automatically a simple relationship of antibiotics and antidepressants, but you've created the conditions for very bad interactions.
Interestingly, with the harmful effects of antidepressants on the environment and humans now coming to light, another study has shown that antidepressants and psychiatric medications over time may not be doing anything in improving the overall quality of life of the patient. In a study on millions of Americans, after 2 years, those taking antidepressants reported feeling no better regarding either physical or mental quality of life issues than those not taking the drugs.
For decades, we thought that the primary pathology, the primary cause of depression, was some abnormality in these neurotransmitters, specifically serotonin or norepinephrine.
However, norepinephrine and serotonin did not seem to be able to account for the symptoms of depression in people who had major depression. Instead, the chemical messengers between the nerve cells in the higher centers of the brain involved in regulating mood and emotion, which include glutamate and GABA, were possibilities as alternative causes for the symptoms of depression.
Dr. David Katz, the founding director of the Prevention Research Center at Yale University and president of the Preventive Medicine Advocacy Organization, said that he was not surprised by the study findings, adding that antidepressant drugs tend to be only nominally effective even in the short term. He also added that much of the impact of the drugs is because of their placebo effect.
I think the overuse of antibiotics has antidepressants, and that has been documented for a very long time. And we all know that it reduces people's immunity. That's the very first thing. It also goes into, you know, through animals, through the food supply chain, and then enters back into human bodies in that way. And of course, then what happens is people who are eating this kind of low quality food are then also, you know, taking drugs, antidepressants, and other kinds of opioids, for example, that is causing them to get other diseases. And for example, there's a study just released not very long ago, a couple of weeks ago, about the extraordinary rise of syphilis in, I think it was Mississippi, one of the states in America, extraordinary rise in syphilis. And a lot of this has got to do with that antibiotics, also to do with the fact that hospitals are still very, very overcrowded in America, and access to getting testing and prenatal care and things like that are quite difficult for many Americans. You know, only 16 Americans are fully covered by Medicare or Medicare aid, and that leaves a very, very large proportion of people in America without a health or safety net.
In the 70s, the American Psychiatric Association, APA, fearing to lose its legitimacy, sought to brand psychiatrists as medical doctors who are treating patients with diseases. This rebranding also called for a different definition for depression, so that depression would be known as a disease that would require medication for treatment. Not surprisingly, pharmaceutical companies jumped aboard, campaigning in support of so-called depression awareness so as to make the billions of dollars they are making today off psychiatric drugs.
What's called Big Pharma, the very large famous pharmaceutical chemical medicine producing houses like Merck, AstraZeneca, many other kinds of AstraZeneca, many other kinds of companies. They have been allowed through deregulation for 30 or 40 years to just play the market and produce mood drugs for antidepressants and other things, and not have the support and direction and ordering by the national government of what kind of research and what kind of manufacturing of medications would be in the public interest. Because instead of making profits, which is all right, it's fair enough, by producing reliable and good drugs, the companies have switched to producing opiates of all kinds and even raising certain kinds of medicines and mood drugs in abroad from the United States. And this should instead, they should be ordered, induced, and pressured to produce the vaccines and the medications, both for the U.S. and wherever needed internationally. This is a matter of the public welfare.
There are little evidence to prove that antidepressants are actually helping psychiatric patients, while there are many that show that they are in reality harming them. 6 out of 7 psychiatric patients report that they experience drug side effect without any benefit. The most common side effect may be sexual dysfunction, which at times lasts long after the patients stop taking the drugs. This side effect can cause problems that might make the patient feel depressed as a result. What is being done to limit the use of antidepressants and antibiotics that cause drug resistance?
You know, the decent health experts and doctors and medical specialists do recommend, do not misuse and widely use antibiotics. It's better to have your farm animals as well as your population be in the best circumstances to be able to naturally resist microbes, viruses, and bacteria. And the best way to ensure that is for high technology family scale farms, so the farmer can make the decision, does an animal need an antibiotic, but only get it under certain circumstances.
Millions of Americans suffering with psychiatric problems and depression turn to antidepressants or other drugs to try and relieve their suffering. The COVID-19 pandemic and its effect on the economy and living elevated depression and drug use. Many Americans coping with psychological disorders or pain turn to other drugs in hope of finding relief. One such drug is the dangerous fentanyl drug, which can be purchased by prescription or illegally in the black market.
Well, the existent problem is already very large, and there's very many deaths. And what we've seen is that the United States government has made efforts to blame everybody else. You know, they've said that Mexico is, the source and the causing the drug problem. They've said that all of these drugs are coming from China and China should do more about these drug problems. That opium and other drugs came from Afghanistan and they should do more about that. So this, of course, is obfuscation. I mean, this is not the real cause. The real cause is demand, and that demand is being caused because people do not have the education, do not have the health standards that are required and needed, that Big Pharma is making profits at the expense of the health of the nation, even though they, obviously say they're helping by the development of their drugs, but actually they're profit-making and they don't really think about this, and there's very few controls on them. And mental health, of course, also is on the rise in the United States. And look, all of this equates to the way that the United States is being run. It subjugates its trade policy and its domestic policies to foreign policy. It spends enormous amounts of money that it has to borrow because of the power of the dollar to fund all of this. And that in itself is decreasing the purchasing power of the dollar and undermining the salaries and wages and services, health, education, infrastructure in the country. And I think, that's going to continue. And wealth inequality in America is the highest anywhere. And I don't see any end to this problem. I don't think that the government is making any true effort to realize an end to this problem. They're just passing the buck and blaming everybody else.
Fentanyl is a strong opioid drug that is often prescribed when other sedative or pain relief medication is not enough to relieve the patient's pain. Fentanyl, however, is found to be addictive, and not only that, some experts believe that the drug itself makes it extremely difficult to start addiction treatment. Fentanyl is a main cause of drug overdose, which has taken the lives of nearly 108,000 Americans in 2021.
There is a plague of drug use in the United States, and in fact, it's so bad that the leading cause of death of Americans between the ages of 18 years old and 45 years old is drugs, directly through overdose or otherwise through indirect debilitation and sickening of their bodies. So the widespread prescription or black market use of synthetic opioids like fentanyl and others has reached extreme proportions. And in addition, sometimes there are other things that contribute to the likelihood of death connected to it. There's a substance that's used in veterinary for animals as a tranquilizer, and that's added into fentanyl. And it's been very bad in Philadelphia and New Jersey. So there are many stories about this, but overall, this is an epidemic of drug use resulting in the actual increased death rate in the United States.
The drug epidemic is alarming in the United States. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration's 2021 National Survey on Drug Use and Health discovered that 16.5% of the American population, which makes close to 47 million people aged 12 and above, had a substance use disorder in the past year. 24 million individuals were classified as having a drug use disorder. How does prescribing fentanyl and its addiction side effects affect the high number of drug overdose deaths in the U.S.?
Fentanyl is a big problem. So the opioid addiction in America, and not just in America, but other advanced economies, but America has the worst sort of outbreak of this. And as I said before, it's very much related to lower living standards, low salaries, and the depopulation of country areas. You see, a lot of this problem with opioids is not only in big cities where you might think it's going to happen in big cities, but it's actually happening in poorer rural areas as well, or semi-rural areas, where there's a big lack of cultural and other kind of health services, educational services, those sorts of things. And this mostly affects people with lower education standards, and that's quite a few people these days in America, because it's so expensive to go to university. And the worst affected group are those that have not finished high school. And in America, that's surprising, but that number is very, very big. Yes, the side effects of this, of course, are, you know, there's violence, all the drug crime, you know, rising prison populations, all sorts of problems like that. Yes, mostly this, of course, is the same group of people. This is lower income groups with lower education levels.
Now, with the surge of opioid addiction and drug overdose, the Biden administration is trying to curb the crisis by reforming and liberalizing federal rules for treating opioid addiction. This would include relaxing the prescription of drugs such as methadone, which is unavailable to Americans who do not have access to special federally approved opioid treatment clinics. Regular physicians are not allowed to prescribe the medication, even though they can prescribe opioids. What would be the future of the drug epidemic in the U.S., and what should be done to stop it?
If the United States, on the positive side, stop the geopolitical kind of warfare orientation and instead moved for economic development and started rebuilding railroads, collaborating in the Americas for water projects with Canada and Mexico, where you had a whole prospect for the population of good jobs and a future for families, you could push down the dependency on drugs. And in addition, we need a cultural shift to go with this. That is, there has been a very bad counterculture from Hollywood and from London and elsewhere for decades for depraved music, the drug culture, that it's clever to take drugs, and for bread and circuses, like in the days of the decline of Rome, where everyone is completely oblivious by being involved in sports, which on their own is a fine thing, physical activity. But people's lives have been so destroyed by the lack of productive employment and a future and hope. If this is done, things could be turned around.
It would not come as a surprise if Big Pharma would also be behind the push to relax rules and regulations for treating opioid addictions. Some might argue that treating a drug addiction with another drug would defeat the purpose. Methadone itself is an opioid that might cause physical dependence and addiction. So whether it is patients taking opioid to relieve the pain or feed their addiction, or if they intend to cure their addiction, they would still be filling the coffers of Big Pharma. That is what is called a win-win situation for pharmaceutical companies.
Big Pharma is a very big problem because it's a kind of a strange cycle, isn't it? I mean, these drug companies promote to doctors the prescription of their drugs. This has been famously documented everywhere. Doctors going on holidays to Las Vegas and so forth, paid by drug companies. And so there's sort of kickbacks, if you like, for doctors that prescribe more of those drugs. And so they're very freely promoted and prescribed. And the government keeps widening that window to allow more drugs of these kinds, opioids and antidepressants and so forth, to be prescribed. And then they're prescribed mostly to the people that, you know, I'm not going to say that people don't need them, but I'm going to say that to groups who, as we've talked about before, lower income, lower education, they don't really understand medical and health situations, and the doctors are obviously promoting these drugs to them. And the health companies, of course, make a lot of money out of this. And we know that during COVID, for example, and the mRNA-type COVID vaccines, it was the US government that funded the research and development of these drugs, but it's the pharmaceutical companies that are keeping the profits. They're not paying back the government and taxpayers that money. And so this is also the problem related to, antibiotics in farms and in animals, also with opioids and antidepressants. It's a kind of a vicious circle. The pharmaceutical companies make a lot of money. The doctors then promote the use of these drugs, and then the people that use them have more health problems and need to go back to their doctors. And look, this is a vicious cycle, and Big Pharma needs to be controlled more. But I think in America that's going to be very difficult. The rise of Big Pharma is a real problem, an economic and social problem.
Antidepressants and other forms of drugs are used frequently in the United States. Health experts are concerned over the use of these drugs that is now being revealed that not only has very little or no benefit to the user, it harms others and the environment by causing drug resistance and the creation of superbugs. Pharmaceutical companies, however, are only concerned about their profits. So with the doctors and politicians all benefiting from the sale of drugs, there is little hope in controlling the so-called Big Pharma.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Almighty Allah, you are a true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You're listening to The Last Savior. This is your host, Zainab. I am with Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, dear listeners, as we know, to know about Imam of our time, it's really important to know about the Imam himself, and it's also important to know about his friends and foes. And some of his friends and foes have been discussed in the signs. Yes, we had been talking about the signs of reappearance, and right now we had been talking about a person named Sufyani who will rise before the reappearance of Imam. We had been talking about the War of Kyrgyzstan in our previous episode. We said that Sufyani, who is one of the certain signs of reappearance, is on his way from Syria to Iraq. And in between, there's going to be a horrible war among the oppressive groups. And a lot of people are going to be killed, which is known as the War of Kyrgyzstan. Do we have some more information about the war?
Let me just base my discussion on some of the narrations that we have received from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. For example, in another narration, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, Yadharu Sufyani ala Sham, Sufyani will conquer Sham. Then there would be a fight between them in a place known as Kyrgyzstan. In this war, the number of the people who are killed is so high that the birds and the beasts of the earth would come and eat from the dead bodies, and all of them would get filled. And in yet another narration, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says, the army of Sufyani will pass by Kyrgyzstan. There would be a war in Kyrgyzstan. 100,000 people are going to be killed in this war from the oppressive people, referring to the fact that both sides of this war are among the oppressive people, and no believer, of course, is involved and is killed. This is in Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, chapter 14, page 288, hadith number 77. So there are a couple of points that we can get from all the narrations about the war of Kyrgyzstan. One point is that the number of the narrations about this war is telling us that this is one of the events that for sure will take place. So Sufyani, after stabilizing himself in Syria, after ruling over these places.
So this is one of the events that's surely going to take place.
Exactly.
The War of Kyrgyzstan. Yeah. Wherein thousands of people are going to get killed, almost, you said, 1,100. All right, so we are talking about a war which is certainly going to take place, and thousands of people are going to get killed in this war.
So, as I mentioned, the conclusions from all these narrations is that, first of all, it will happen. Second of all, one of the sides is Sufyani. And the third is that both sides are what we call it Ahlul Batil, with the falsehood. Both sides are among Jabbarin, the oppressive people, and the Shias are not involved. And the fourth point is that so many people are going to be killed in this war. And finally, the army of Sufyani, although they will have also heavy casualties, but they will finally win the war. They will defeat their enemies in this war. The narrations do not refer to, the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt about the reason of this war and who is the other side. But it might be that We know that Sufyani, when he's going to attack Kufa or Iraq, he's going to conquer all the lands and regions between Syria and Kufa or Iraq,
all
which
right.
includes a number of regions and places. So it might be that, I mean, some of the countries, some of the regions, rulers in these places, they will resist against Sufyani, and that is why we will have the war of Kyrgyzstan between Sufyani and those people, which of course are not with truth.
Right, yes. All right. We'll discuss more on the topic after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old
Welcome back. You're listening to The Last Savior. I'm with Dr. Karimi, and we are talking about the certain signs of reappearance. One of them is a person named Sufyani, his uprising, and now we're talking about the course of his events, and one of the course of his events is the War of Kyrgyzstan, which is a horrible war, and a lot of people are going to be killed in this war. Yes, Dr. Karimi.
I think I almost refer to all the points about this war. Just to show how horrible this war is, let me just share one last narration from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. In this narration, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says that سَيَكُونُ بِهَا وَقْعَةٌ, in this place, in Kyrgyzstan, there would be an event, a war, لَمْ يَكُنْ مِثْلُهَا مُنْذُ خَلَقَ اللَّهُ تَبَارَكَ وَتَعَالَى السَّمَوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ, the like of which has not happened from the creation of the heavens and the earth. وَلَا يَكُونُ مِثْلُهَا مَا دَمَتُ السَّمَوَاتُ وَالْأَرْضِ, and the like of it will not happen in the future. And then the Imam says that, like the other similar narrations, it would be a kind of table of food for the birds and for the beasts. A caller will call out that hasten toward eating the from the flesh of the oppressive people. So this is, as you mentioned, a horrible war. But alhamdulillah, the Shias, the believers, are not involved at all. Only
sides
two
are
groups
the falsehood.
Of oppressive people will fight each other, and many people are going to be killed. But finally, Sufyani will win the war, will defeat the other side, and then he begins
his journey
towards
Iraq.
So in the next stage, Sufyani will go toward Iraq. There are two groups of the narrations about what Sufyani is going to do after his victory in the
War
of Kyrgyzstan. According to some narrations, he will attack Iraq. And according to some other narrations, he will send two armies to Iraq and Medina.
All right.
So, for example, in one narration, the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family is quoted as saying, خَرَجَ عَلَيْهِمُ سُفْيَانِ مِنَ الْوَادِ الْيَابِسِ. Sufyani will begin his uprising from Al-Wadi al-Yabis, which we said that is one of the regions in Syria. فَيَبْعَثُ جَيْشَيْن, جَيْشَيْن إِلَى الْمَشْرِقِ وَجَيْشَيْن إِلَى الْمَدِينَةِ. He will send two armies, one toward the east, that is Iraq, and one toward Medina. So according to this narration, he will send two armies. But in another narration, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, in an authentic narration, after referring to the war of Kyrgyzstan, he says, وَيَبْحَثَ سُفْيَانِ جَيْشًا إِلَى الْكُوفَةِ. After that, Sufyani will send an army toward Kufa. This is in Al-Ghiba by Nu'mani, page 288, hadith number 67.
There are certain narrations which are talking about after this war of Kyrgyzstan, where Sufyani is heading to. We'll discuss more on this after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned with us.